Welcome to Bridging the Gap. We are Alaskans discussing issues that divide us in order to find solutions that will unite us. Welcome to Bridging the Gap. Today is the 15th in a series of panel discussions of Alaskans examining issues that divide us politically in these turbulent times. My name is Paul Thomas. I live in Trapper Creek. The objective of the panel discussion is to derive, through questions posed to the participants, an understanding of the causes that have resulted in the current polarization of American political discourse. Subsequent to achieving a satisfactory understanding of the causes, it is hoped that through further discussion, a strategy for positive interaction can be constructed, which can achieve a respectful accommodation of each side towards the other. Today we have Panthea Redwood and Michelle Church, an anonymous tech guy who may be popping his opinion in here every once in a while. And we're going to be talking about foreign policy today. So thanks, ladies, for coming by and helping me out here. We may have another guest later on, but we'll see if he manages to show up. So the first question here is, there are a lot of complexities currently with the U.S. relationship with Russia because it is basically a relationship between Trump and Putin. And how would you characterize that relationship?
Well, it appears to be pretty chummy on their part, although it seems like, at least with what happened with Syria, there was maybe an attempt to look like America was taking a harder stand against Russia.
Our U.N. ambassador got shanghaied there.
Right.
It seemed pretty tough until that point.
Right. But it seemed more like a PR move almost for the Trump administration to be able to show that they weren't, in fact, so closely in bed with Russia. And but then, you know, when it came down to issuing sanctions, Trump backpedaled on it.
And that just happened just yesterday. To those of you who are unaware of the situation, our U.N. ambassador, Ambassador Haley, had gone on the Sunday morning talk shows and explained to everybody that we are taking a very strong stand about these chemical weapons in Syria, and Russia's support of the Syrian government was going to result in U.S. sanctions against Russia. And she told everybody that on Sunday. And then the next day, the president said he wasn't ready to go forward with those sanctions. He didn't feel quite comfortable with those sanctions, and so he withdrew them. And there's still the story is really not completely written here between Haley and Larry Kudlow, the new economic advisor to the president. So, Panthea, do you have any ideas on what you'd like to share regarding Putin and Trump?
It seems a really strange thing for the head of a dictatorship, literally, and the head of the United States to be quite so chummy. I would have hoped that our president would have shown himself to be way more of a statesman rather than
a buddy.
A buddy, exactly. It really, I think, demeans the presidency of the United States. I mean, I have had a hard time watching our relationship with China, and it just seems like we're going to go down the same road with Russia that we've done with China, which is to underestimate their ability to outthink, outsmart, outdo the United States. Mm-hmm. And we just don't seem to get it. We seem to think because we have been so successful in the past that there's an automatic assumption that we're going to be as successful in the future. Right now I'm taking a class and we've looked at civilizations through the centuries, And typically you get a civilization, it builds up economically and socially, culturally, and then it continues to build and build and build until the point at which it gets a, I don't know how to say this politely, but it gets a person who's not quite capable of handling the job, and the civilization goes downhill. And you can see this with so many throughout the world. So
in your experience, you've seen the decline of civilizations mainly due to dysfunctional leadership occurring at a particular point.
Exactly.
And, wow, that's pretty profound about how America might have just, you know, is starting to achieve that dysfunctional relationship.
This doesn't pertain to Russia, but I was in China, and I was just astonished, to be honest, absolutely astonished, because when I was there...
What year was that?
Oh, gosh. 2011.
Okay, not that long ago then.
No. The head of General Electric had been in China at that point, announcing, this was through the American paper in Beijing, that he was opening 26 jobs. I get back to the United States, and that day, the same guy announces that they're really, really, really sorry, but they're going to close 18 factories in the United States. And here we just are allowing, especially China, I mean, you look at everything on sale in the U.S. at this point. Reminds me very much of years ago when Japan was...
Right at the end of World War II, Japan was flooding us with their products, which they could make very cheaply.
Right, and that's what we're seeing now with China. How many things can you actually buy now that aren't made in China? So I just, you know, I worry about our relationships with Russia. Right now, Russia is relatively poor country, but I think we're absolutely foolish to pretend that somehow Putin is going to do something different than any of his predecessors.
Syria has been a horrible catastrophe. Russia is also in that fight, along with Iran, Hezbollah, ISIS, the Kurds, the Turks, and the United States, not to mention the various rebel camps that continue to operate in Syria. Is there any scenario that you can envision that would result in a peaceful, stable Syria? From this point where we're at right now, is there any storyline that we could come up with that's going to make it okay in Syria?
I think that there will have to be a replacement war. It seems after World War II, when America sort of changed from a manufacturing industry that produced goods for Americans, it became this industrial military machine. And I think a few very wealthy, connected folks saw there was a lot of money in that. And so it seems like it's all based on there has to be a conflict going somewhere in order for these military complexes to make money.
And we're not only talking about America. There's Israeli manufactured arms.
Right.
There's Russian manufactured arms. There's all kinds of arms we manufacture.
Right.
So basically what you're saying is that I'm trying not to paraphrase here or put words in your mouth, that as long as this military-industrial complex, this industry itself, needs wars to go on, we're going to have someplace like Syria always.
Right. I think so. I think horribly what may have to happen or what may end up happening is if there becomes a point where there is a conflict between Russia and America, that will be so big that basically Syria will just sort of fall to the wayside as far as our focus is concerned, and they will figure out whatever they're going to figure out within their own country. You know, it's a very destabilized area it didn't used to be. Damascus, my father was in the oil business, and he spent a lot of time there. And it was a beautiful city, very modern, very lovely. And
with an ancient culture,
right.
Architecture. Yeah.
And yet they still embraced sort of this what was good for the Syrian people. There seemed to be wealth. There didn't seem to be as much infighting. You know, maybe that's ignorant on my part, but it has become just this absolute dire situation that I don't see how, unless another conflict comes in to sort of take its place.
Yeah, you mentioned at the beginning replacement war. So what exactly was that?
Well, I think if we end up with a big conflict with North Korea or with China or with Russia.
Another war to divert attention.
Right. Yeah. Suddenly that will be the war of the day. It'll be a bigger war. And so all of our resources will go towards that. And we'll bail on it, and Russia perhaps as well. I don't know.
It depends on if their attention is diverted elsewhere,
right.
Too. Yeah. Panthea, is any way to fix Syria?
I don't know. I really haven't a clue, because you could tell 10 years ago that we were going to bomb Syria and that we were just looking for an excuse to do so. We had already gone into Iraq and then Afghanistan. And really, if you look at history, when the United States has had a downturn economically, what has gotten them up again? A war. And it's been this economic cycle. And I don't think that our foreign policy has changed at all. We
get involved in these wars somehow. We seem to be major players.
Well, we are. And I'm just thinking, I'm taking this class right now, and you had all of these little, talking about China, but you had all these little principalities, as it were. And who was the one who would always sell weapons when other countries would not, for a moral or whatever reason? The U.S. always will sell weapons to whoever wants them, to even our so-called enemies.
Right? Would Trump tearing up the Iran nuclear treaty advance world peace? He's been threatening to do that. He has Pompeo now, who likes the idea of tearing up that treaty, which was negotiated not only with the Americans under the Obama administration, but many European and many other Western nations, including Russia. So would Trump tearing up that treaty help or hurt matters?
Well, first of all, why does he want to tear it up? What has he got to gain?
Mm-hmm. Well, there's one theory that he wants to tear it up because Obama was the one that brought it, and anything that Obama does has to be torn up. That's one theory.
Right. I think that's the biggest failing of this administration is it isn't based on any kind of sound policy or any strategy. It's based on these, knee-jerk reactions of Trump undoing everything that Obama did just simply because Obama did it, whether it makes any sense or not. So I don't see how that's going to – it isn't going to help anything.
Certainly won't help.
Well, we can look at the proposed negotiations of the denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula right now. And just yesterday, or just today, it was revealed that Pompeo went as his envoy to meet with the North Korean dictator. And they were talking about how this is going to advance the denuclearization. But what I would see Well, what I'm proposing that we look at is the fact that we already negotiated a denuclearization treaty with Iran. And that was signed on by Iran and us and a lot of other nations. And if we tear that up, what kind of confidence is North Korea going to have about our ability to keep our word?
None.
I don't see Kim Jong-un being willing to give up that power. I don't see that happening.
No. It's funny. I just wrote a paper on something called Bushido, which was the writer considered the soul of Japan. And Bushido is a concept that you must fight, that as a Japanese, you must be military, that in order to be even a good person, you have to either be in the military or supporting the military or donating to the military. And you see Japan now attempting to renege on its trying to change its constitution so that it will be able to have nuclear power again.
Constitution that was installed after World War II, after
exactly.
We beat them.
Exactly. So there's all this pressure to be able to use nuclear armaments. I can't see that any of them are going to help us to come to world peace. The more nuclear, we have so many nuclear weapons that we could destroy the planet now. It just makes no sense to add more countries that have their own downfalls, as it were.
And if we list the number of nations that have nuclear weapons, we can go Israel, Britain, France, North Korea, U.S., Russia. Are these really stable nations? Have they been behaving stably lately?
No.
And that's the
Well, biggest. And I think they would say that America's not behaving stably now.
Right.
I don't think China is not going to support a cohesive Korea with South Korea, North Korea coming together because that destabilizes the power structure that exists there right now. So I
think if North Korea and South Korea, if there wasn't Kim Jong-un to start there, we've gotten rid of him somehow. But I don't think that China has any particular reason to not want North Korea, South Korea to be united, because I think they have every sense that Korea through the years has been the poor batting ball. I mean, Japan invades it. All of these countries have invaded it through the years. That I don't think China particularly would not want them.
So you don't think they would mind if they had Korea united?
No, I really don't.
Unless they're united with nuclear power.
Or without nuclear power.
Right. If they're united without nuclear power,
right,
then they wouldn't be a threat. But if they are united with nuclear power, then they would, I think, have a problem with that.
Right.
So do you think that the fact that we have such a strong military alliance with South Korea, that military alliance would have to be disbanded, in order for China to accept this unification? Because we're always over there with all kinds of war games going on, military exercises with South Korea. We probably have more war exercises with South Korea than any other nation on the planet. Would China accept that? Continuity of that relationship, or would that have to end?
It seemed to me that, and I read this or heard this somewhere, that that's part of North Korea's requirement, is that the U.S. would have to leave South Korea.
Okay. Already a precondition.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, which is why I don't think it's going to happen.
Okay.
But the question you began with was, would China have a a problem with it if it did happen. And I don't think they would, but I don't think it'll happen either.
How does Muslim or Islamic terrorism rank in your mind as a threat to America now, as opposed to September 2001? We remember back those days. We're both old enough to remember September 11th.
Right. I don't think that that those religious states are in and of themselves a threat to America. It's a good soundbite.
Yes.
A lot of fear-mongering going on regarding that.
Yeah, just after Trump was elected, I was sitting in the Fred Meyer parking lot, and a woman I hadn't seen in a long time came over, and we started talking, and it was really very, very friendly and nice. And she mentioned that she voted for Trump, and so when people say that, I like to find out why.
Curiosity.
Yeah, curiosity. I'd like to see where people are coming from, because I like to know people. So I asked her, what about Trump really liked? He said, well, the Muslims, they are going to, if Trump hadn't gotten in, the Muslims were going to invade the United States and force us into Sharia law.
So actually expressed in Fred Meyer's.
Right. Mm-hmm. That, and I was just astounded that someone was truly, and she was truly afraid that they were coming tomorrow and going to enforce Sharia law.
This is Bridging the Gap on KVRF Radio Free Palmer. We're here discussing the issue of foreign policy. I have Panthea Redwood and Michelle Church with us. And I almost forgot to do my little plug there, so Mike, don't get mad at me from afar. One of the first executive orders of the president, if we're staying on the same topic of Islamic terrorism, was the Muslim ban. That didn't work very well in the lower courts, but it seemed like the Supreme Court allowed some portions of that ban to remain in place. Has that helped matters, this Muslim ban? Or is it part of what we were talking about earlier, that keeping the Muslim fear-mongering going on so we can keep that as an issue?
Islamophobia.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Yeah. I think it's a talking point on conservative shows that we need to have somebody to hate. And we need to have an enemy out there, and that is a handy little enemy, because it's America is this, quote, Christian nation, and a lot of people are very threatened by the idea that another religion would come in and take over, which is absurd in my mind. But yeah, it is. It's keeping that fear alive. That the reason that we continue to have all the checks and balances at the airports and things like that is really based on, I think, a false premise.
I agree.
So the airport security is not a good idea. I'm not saying I shouldn't put it that way, but the airport security has been a result of this this fear that's been installed.
And what has it gotten? I find Anchorage's TSA people obnoxious.
You've never been to Philadelphia?
Well, I haven't been to Philadelphia, but I've been to a lot of other places. And I'm 77 years old, and I have to use a wheelchair to get around. And I don't know where they think I'm going to be holding a submachine gun or whatever those assault weapons are. I mean, it's the wheelchairs, they can check anytime. They're the standard ones the airport has. So where on my body am I going to even be able to hold such a weapon? It's just...
Are they making you go through x-rays?
I'm not able to stand in the x-ray.
Okay.
So I have to go through in the wheelchair.
Uh-huh.
Well, when I go through in San Francisco, Seattle, there's the one, Washington, D.C., those are the recent ones I've been through. In fact, if you're 75, you don't even have to take your shoes off now, because they realize once you're 75, your capability of taking down somebody is really limited, especially as a woman. I shouldn't say that. I bet there are some 78-year-old women out there who are good to it. But I just I find it just obnoxious, and I don't see – well, I should say the benefit is – we now have a new class of workers that don't require education.
Jobs.
Mm. Yeah.
Government jobs. To
Yeah, and good so good jobs in that
mm-hmm.
sense.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was George Carlin, who's been gone a long time and, you know, before all of this other stuff, I think he said that something like, you know, when grandmothers are going to be a threat to taking down your plane, it's pretty much game over.
Yeah.
That's a good point.
So if that's the case, then we kind of
we've lost the war at that point.
Right.
They've won.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, there are a lot of talking heads that are worried about the Trump-Kim summit, that they could have dire consequences when these two guys get together. If it turns out to be a photo op with nothing else negotiated or accomplished, smiling Kim, smiling Donald, would that be so bad?
Who cares?
Yeah. So you don't think these pundits really, they're spousing off these dire consequences? You don't think that's...
The only dire consequence that I could see would be that Trump would think that he's going to really be a buddy of Kim Jong-un, and he's not. Kim's too smart for that. But I'm not sure Trump is.
Right. I'm not sure I would attach smart to either of those guys. there's certainly more strategy going on, and I see this as Trump's base is going to say, you know, he's such a great negotiator, and look at him, he's going and he's talking to these people that nobody else has talked to, but there's actually a strategic and a foreign policy reason why other people haven't talked to these folks. And I agree. I think that he thinks he's going to be a friend, and I'm not sure that you want as your BFFs to be Putin and Kim Jong-un.
Right.
I don't think that bodes well for America.
Trump didn't have any problem throwing Nikki Haley under the bus here yesterday or today, and so And he seems to promote this idea, especially with the premier in Russia, President Xi, that as long as we're buddies, all this other stuff, that's
right.
Put that by the wayside, because we have a good relationship. And, you know, I even gave him some really great chocolate cake down at Mar-a-Lago.
And, mm-hmm. I have a friend who works for the State Department on the China desk. It's really startling to hear what people who actually work for the State Department think about all of these. I mean, it's just...
There's not too many people left that work for the State Department.
That's right.
Given the 14 months of the Trump presidency, we still don't have a Secretary of State and a lot of other ambassadorships. No ambassadors to South Korea, I don't think, or a lot of other very important places. So that's probably a good segue. What is the nature now of the United States foreign policy, given the structure of the State Department? Is it bad? Is it because all these positions aren't filled and these nuts and bolts duties aren't being taken care of? Or is it something that we can just say, well, this is going to be okay because it's Trump and he'll take care of it. Or
there's no way I would think that it's okay. Trump will take care of it. I don't think Trump understands the nuances that are necessary for successful negotiations. I think if he thinks, I'm afraid he thinks that he's buddies with all of the biggies in the world, and so he's a biggie too. But by decimating his Department of State, he and the Foreign Service as well, it's not just the Department of State, he's really decimating our ability to know and understand what's going on in these countries so that we are prepared for what they are going to do. You know they're going to do something. But at this point, when you take your own staff, as it were, and throw it out and leave yourself as the only guy in the tiger pit, I just don't think that's a very good idea.
Is it right. worrisome, Michelle?
I think so. I think, you know, in the modern day Game of Thrones, America is losing.
Yes.
I think we've lost credibility. A lot of other countries are sort of really not paying attention to or not putting much weight in whatever comes out of America, quote unquote, policy, because it flip-flops from day to day. They don't really know what to expect. And so they're sort of like, okay, well, they've, you know, kind of lost it, and we're just going to continue on without them. So I think America's losing our stance as a global power because we, you know, kind of have this clownish foreign policy thing going on.
This kind of like leads into this next question here that I've been reading, the claim for decades now, for 30 years or more, that Ronald Reagan won the Cold War. So does Putin believe that Cold War was lost to Russia? And I think based on what you're saying, Michelle, that you don't think that's the case at all, that Putin thinks that this Cold War is winnable for the Russians.
Right. I think it is. I think we what we did with Russia, or what Russia did to themselves, is they put so much into trying to be this superpower that they bankrupted themselves. And if you look at our national debt, that's what's happening here. And at some point, these other countries can, you know, just call in their chips and
China owns a lot of U.S. Treasury bonds.
We're going to be in
way more than you think. It's up now to just about 40%.
It's just an unreported fact. I mean, it's out there. You can check it out, but it's not in people's consciousness.
Not at all. People are not. I keep going back to China, but when I was in China, I came back from there just feeling we've lost it. And this was before Trump. We're taking all of our jobs and sending them out to other countries. We're losing the ability to have jobs in the United States. And this was, I felt this before Trump, that the United States was on a downhill slide. And maybe it's just because it is on a downhill slide, we get who we've gotten for president.
How does NATO look these days? You remember NATO, North Atlantic Treaty Organization, where we had France and England and most of Europe against the Warsaw Pact, which was the Soviet and their satellites. How does NATO look these days?
I don't know that America has any standing in NATO anymore. I mean, that's what it feels like.
Since January of 2017.
Well, yeah, for sure.
Yeah. What do you think about NATO, Panther?
I don't know.
You don't know anything about NATO?
No. I haven't heard anything. So sort of worry in a way that when you haven't heard of something.
Right. Something happening with NATO.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I guess no news is good news.
I don't know. In this case, you know, sometimes it's good news, but I really worry about the fact that the intelligence, and I mean not in the sense of smart, but the ability of our country to reason out what it is that these other countries are going to do in 10 years or in 20 years, to think long term and be able to develop this country enough to withstand it. What, as it is now, the president thinks, oh, I have all these nuclear bombs, I don't have to worry. Well, that isn't actually a strategy. That it, what you do with that is you may win the war, but you lose the planet. So is that an acceptable policy? No. But there's a dearth of policy now coming out of Washington to replace what we had, because we don't have the staff there to develop it. You mentioned how many people the State Department has lost. That's just one example.
America is we're a consumer nation, and really the only thing that we are it's sort of like the state of Alaska. We have all of our eggs in the oil basket, and it seems like America has all of its eggs in the military basket. And right. So it really requires that there be conflict continuing in order for us to maintain the only thing that we are that our economy is based on. It's military.
Alaska is really hurting now from having all those eggs in the oil basket.
Right.
Down there in lower 48, it seems like there's a kind of a booming economy, low unemployment. And who gets credit for that, Trump or Obama? We won't get into that now. But Alaska, because everything was in oil and we didn't have any tax base to sustain our state government, now we have that issue to deal with. So back in the old Cold War days, there was the Western Alliance. All right. The Western Alliance was led by the U.S. and it included NATO, which we talked about a little bit. And in the Pacific region, we also talked about Japan and South Korea. And opposing the Western Alliance was the communist nations, okay, which were China, Russia, Cuba, you know, for a while.
I don't think it's correct to lump communist nations. They're so different. They really are. Even their so-called communism isn't even the same. I mean, the Marxism that you see in China is totally different from that which you see in Cuba, for example. And even different from that coming out, you know, from Stalin days. And I don't think it's correct to lump them all into one basket.
But historically, there was at that point.
Oh, yeah, there
in
was.
In the 60s, 70s, and all the way into
right,
the 80s,
but I don't think
there was this conflict between the West.
There still is a conflict, but I'm not sure the same players are on the same side anymore. I don't really see Cuba as a communist nation. Especially after it's been open for trade.
But does that Western Alliance still exist?
I don't know.
And if it does exist, is the United States still in a leadership role in that Western Alliance?
I think a lot of people that voted for Trump think that's the case. I think that really where we have failed is we became very complacent and we were so sure that America was the strongest, greatest country in the world, and so we really stopped worrying about educating our kids on what these different – I mean I'm not sure I even understand, but I think I understand a little bit better than – some folks that there's a difference between communism and socialism and fascism and capitalism but I don't think that America sees that. They don't. I don't think we understand what those terms mean. And it's all about, you know, America, the capitalists, the, you know, freedom, you know, wave the flag. but not really understanding.
So you would say that there's a lot of ideological confusion among Americans today.
Well, think of all the fear when, as soon as someone said in the presidential campaign, that's socialist.
I mean, you're talking about Bernie, because Bernie was
exactly
right.
There was fear that socialism was some like monster out there, which they had no idea what it was, but all they knew was it was bad.
Mm-hmm.
They had no concept of what that they might in fact be really better off with socialism, but you just put that label on and.
Well, we had a previous show about socialism versus capitalism, and there was some examples that, you know, that I brought up, like Norway. You know, Norway is so incredibly socialist in their energy, their hydropower, their medical, their banking is state run, and their cost of, or their standard of living is number one.
Absolutely.
On the planet. And so it was that mix of socialism that has we have been reluctant to employ as much, even though historically the U.S. went in a very socialist direction back in the New Deal days.
Oh, absolutely.
And there, you know, a lot of historians, myself included, believe that saved America because the people were then taken care of.
Right.
Through programs like Social Security, and then back in the Great Society, Medicare.
Right.
I'm on Medicare and Social Security now, and I don't think that, you know, I'm going to be able to work too much longer. And so, we need those kind of safety nets.
Well, it was sort of like the conversation that we had before as far as Obamacare and people saying that they hated Obamacare, they wanted Obamacare to go away, but they wanted the ACA to stay.
Mm-hmm.
And it was because they just didn't understand what any of that meant.
No, that they were the same.
Right.
Yeah. That was tragic.
What do we feel about pulling out of the Paris Climate Accords? That was, I think, nearly 130-some nations signed on to it. And I believe it was Nicaragua or one of those, and the United States. Well, we were in it, we were threatened to be pulled out, but I don't think we quite pulled out yet. Or no, yes, we did pull out. Yes,
yeah,
Trump did pull out. Yeah. What effect has that
pull
out had, or what effect do you think will it have on our future in relation to our other nations who have stayed with it?
Well, again, I think it's. They're saying, okay, fine, we're just going to go ahead because they realize from a scientific standpoint that that's what has to happen. And so they're just, you know, they sort of, I think, shake their heads and will continue on. And again, that's another, I believe, loss of power and strength that America has in the world's view of America. As an intelligent player.
Prestigious leader.
Right.
We're losing our prestige as
Definitely.
Leader. So you feel the same way about the Paris Accords are pulling out? It's hurt us?
Yeah, I think I really, it's, again, I use the word tragic, but it really is tragic that the leaders now just, they're so afraid of climate. I have a friend who is so afraid because climate change is obviously it's happened in the past, happened now. The point is that it's a rapid change. It's the pace of change that's a problem. And people just can't seem to get that. But I have a friend who is still really afraid because he feels, well, if it's true that humans can affect the climate, then what else can humans do? So he says they didn't. Humans don't affect the climate.
So his fear
of
human destructive tendencies
exactly.
has caused him to believe that it couldn't be happening.
And therefore there is no climate change.
Except, you know, humans are really the only being on the planet that could disappear and would have no effect.
Right.
I'll take that as a bad effect. Okay, with Rex Tillerson being out, Rex Tillerson, former Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo is the Secretary of State designate. We should say at this time that he has not been confirmed by the Senate yet. H.R. McMaster's National Security Advisor is out, and John Bolton is now the National Security Advisor because he doesn't need to be confirmed. So do we have any concerns about those particular personnel changes?
Yeah.
What would those concerns be?
Well, again, these are folks that appear to be ideologues that don't really understand the strategic impact of the decisions that they're making, and they're going on what their ideology is, and it seems very destructive to me. His Trump's whole cabinet seems to be all about basically destroying America.
That's pretty profound, but I think you're going to find
that's a bumper sticker.
You find a lot of people that agree with that assessment. Look at Scott Pruitt, and those EPA regulations rolled back. So, are you concerned about those personnel changes?
Well, I think any thinking person has to be concerned, because in the long run, taking away people who have the ability to think as opposed to just react is not helpful for the United States. That, just to say, well, climate change doesn't exist, that's just a reaction. And it doesn't get us anywhere because the climate continues to change and we continue to not do anything about it. Till we're going to get past the point where we can do anything about it. And having people who are so reactive in places of power, yes, it really worries me. I think that's I keep hoping that some glimmer in one of these men they'll suddenly switch and now look at things differently. But
I think last time we were here, we asked the question about what is going to be seen, and I think it was you, Michelle, that said the November election is going to make a determination as to how this if this is going to become less reactive, as you described the pandemic,
right,
or if we're going to become progressive again in trying to have a future, look for a future.
Right.
Okay, President Obama asked for congressional approval to attack Syria after Assad deployed chemical weapons on his people. That's whenever he talked about the red line. And what he said that he was going to do was, if he stepped over that red line, that there was going to be consequences. And what happened after that was there was a negotiated treaty that occurred that said the chemical weapons would go into the custody of the Russians, and therefore there wouldn't be any more deployment of those chemical weapons on the Syrian people by Assad. At that point, Obama did ask Congress for congressional approval to go after this nation state if they did this, and Congress rejected that approval. Trump didn't ask for approval. Trump just went ahead and sent in his 105 missiles. Every one of them hit their targets. We heard that. Which is a better way to go? The way Obama did it, by asking congressional approval to send missiles into a sovereign state, or Trump's way?
I don't know that all of the missiles hit. I mean, it seemed to me that they didn't. And it appeared to me, from my vantage point, was that there was a lot of heads up to both Assad and to Russia.
48-hour warning.
This is where we're going to bomb. This is, what's going to happen. So they could move anything that they really didn't want to get destroyed out of the way. And again, that's why I think that whole one night of bombing was just a PR play on Trump's part so that he could say, you know, look at me, I draw a line in the sand, and by gosh, they crossed it and we went after them, when actually it had zero effect.
Zero effect, right. After a period of time, he can do whatever he wants again.
Right.
Because he has. And then with Nikki Haley coming out a few days later saying that, you know, we're really going to stop you, Russia, because you're helping Syria, and then have that rug pulled out.
Mm-hmm. Then Putin appears with Trump in a publicity shot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Trump is quite a little puppet for those guys. And I think that, you know, he's going to have, you know, two sets of strings attached to him. One that Putin is controlling, and one that Kim Jong-un.
He's going to rise in status pretty quick to be the very minor national leader in North Korea to the puppet master.
Right,
that's quite a jump.
And he doesn't actually have the power to do that. I mean, it's really a. He hasn't got the economic. All he has are his weapons. He has no. The people there are starving. They have no industry or cultural activities. They have a one purpose, which is to have more toys than any other country.
So they're based very primarily on military as well.
Right, and they, you know, I think. When Kim Jong-un dies, it'll be interesting to see whether the people in North Korea, at some point, they're going to say, enough. We need food. We need grain. We need to eat.
Well, you'd hope that would progress towards that. And maybe with all this... denuclearization, no matter what the definition is, whether it's American definition or North Korean definition, if that occurs, then maybe things might get better for them. Mm-hmm. All over the world, violence produced literally millions of refugees. Mm-hmm. Europe has pretty much maxed out in its capacity to accept political refugees. Some countries in Europe have, you know, over a million refugees they've accepted. Jordan and Lebanon have just huge, giant refugee camps. Is the U.S. doing enough to accept political refugees?
Is it doing anything?
I guess this year the total has been 11 Syrian refugees,
right.
Refugees from Syria. So if the U.S. isn't doing it, what can be done to alleviate this human tragedy? Is there
Have the United States open its borders, for heaven's sakes? I mean, if a small country like Norway can do it, a huge, rich country like the United States could surely do it. They could easily set up transport and ask for volunteers and churches, instead of condemning churches which have been safe havens, support them.
That doesn't play well on campaign flyers,
true,
though.
No.
So you think that the United States lacks the political will to do anything productive with this refugee crisis?
Yeah. Right. It isn't that they can't do it. It's that they aren't doing it.
Right, that would appear to go back on so much of what Trump campaigned on, you know, making America safer again. Again, it's because there's this fear of people who are different. I mean, we're a country of immigrants. That's how we became the powerful nation that we are, because we took people from different backgrounds and different abilities and different ways of thinking, and you come up with better ideas and you become a stronger, more productive country as a result. But we're locking ourselves in to folks that that don't understand the importance of manufacturing our own goods and you know, becoming this consumer nation that's reliant on China or whoever for all of our goods and services.
Our consumer, what we consume.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So this Russian situation, is it something that, and I'm talking about the Russian situation in regard to Mueller's investigation as well as Trump's compliance, if I can't think of any better word than that.
Can we go back to the refugee situation?
Sure. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to cut that off. That's an important topic.
I think it really is an important topic because each group that has come into the United States, whether you talk about the Italians who came in and then wanted to close the doors there, that each nationality has come in, has wanted to close the doors behind them. And we cannot seem to get it to the point of recognizing that we are stronger because we have all of these immigrants from the different countries. And now where, you know, local groups, churches try to have safe houses or places for refugees to stay, they get attacked by the police is, oh, you're bringing in immigrants. Those are foreigners. Where are their papers? We really, as a nation, are able to do so much more for refugees. And if the question would be asked, would you have one in your house? The answer is yes.
Absolutely. Right. And a lot of people have. And there is a distinction between an immigrant that is coming to America to achieve a better economic life as opposed to a political refugee whose status is, I don't have any place else to go because if I go back to where I came from, they're going to kill me dead.
Right. And we need to open our doors to both. My thought.
So how about, very quickly, we have about a minute and a half left. How about the immigration policy in total here? That's actually a foreign policy issue because
yes.
These immigrants are coming from foreign lands.
Right.
So with this DACA thing going on, do you see this Trump strategy or the Trump's positioning against the immigration being expanded or a path to citizenship helping us out, or is that going to make things worse in America?
I don't think Trump's strategy is a good strategy at all. Again, it's the us. It's the different. It's the these people are different, and that plays well to his base. That we want to, you know, we want to keep America white and Christian, and you know, so.
That's your opinion too?
Yeah, I agree completely.
All right. I want to thank you two for helping me out today, coming in and doing a great job. But just the two of you, but you really gave us a lot of information and good insight, especially on China.
Thank you. Thank
this
you
is Bridging the Gap. Thank you so much for listening. Bye. Thanks for listening to Bridging the Gap. We welcome diversified perspectives. If you are interested in becoming a panelist for a future show, send us an email to manager@radiofreepalmer.org.
This program is a production of Radio Free Palmer, recorded at our studios in Palmer, Alaska. The views and opinions of moderators and guests do not necessarily represent those of Radio Free Palmer, this station, or its underwriters.